my actual day-to-day experience was a lot of frustration and disappointment when I would go to different apartment complexes or different potential housing opportunities, and then they would tell me that cost, and it was like just a sinking feeling, right? You know, just a feeling of hopelessness, to be honest with you, and a lot of despair.
The steps out of the despair that Melvin Parson describes could include something called inclusionary zoning, or IZ. IZ links the building of affordable housing with market rate housing. It's been tried in some parts of the country, but here in Michigan, IZ has been outlawed. Let's learn more about inclusionary zoning as we welcome Brett Lennart. He's interim director of the Department of Community and Economic Development for Washtenaw County. And Dennis Sturtevant is with us from Grand Rapids, where he's the longtime executive director of Dwelling Place, which is a housing nonprofit. Well, Dennis, inclusionary zoning, we want to get into that now. It's certainly growing in popularity around the country. Can you give us an example of how it works?
It's essentially a tool to, in some cases it's voluntary, in other cases it's mandatory in some places, to provide a developer with an incentive to create within a project, a development that they might be considering, opportunities for building some affordable housing units within that development. Now, again, it could be home ownership units they're building, could be rental units they're doing. Some communities, instead of requiring that these units actually be in the building or the development where the market rate stuff is, are actually allowing for fees to be paid. Those fees might help to support this housing trust or something like that to create affordable housing units in other locations. Or the developer may be actually involved in an affordable housing development project nearby or something like this. But density bonuses, you can go a few floors higher if you agree to ensure that there's some affordable housing units available. They often also come with affordability restrictions, that is, time limits that these affordable units have to remain affordable too. I know that there's, from what I've seen, there are some communities where that is not a requirement and, you know, it's only the first family in that needs to be an affordable household, but those are more typical, I think, with homeownership type units. With rental units, the affordability restrictions tend to stay on longer. One of the big challenges we have here, of course, is that in these states where this is going on, there's enabling legislation that allows for it. Michigan has not really been open to that. I don't remember the last time there was legislation introduced. I know there's some current conversation going on, but that's one of the problems is we need to, just like downtown development authorities and all these other programs that we have, there's state enabling legislation that allows them to take place.
So there's conversations that you're aware of, but I don't get a sense that there are any solid efforts underway for a legislative fix in terms of the fact that, as you say, mandatory IZ is outlawed in Michigan. Would that be a big start in your mind, Brett, to help things along?
Yeah, absolutely. Having this as a tool gives the community the opportunity to have that conversation to say, okay, how do we want to apply it? In what circumstances? To what extent? Having the flexibility to flesh out some of those details about, is it a first family in? Is it over a period of time? In markets such as Ann Arbor, the amenities and the quality of life, the access to parks, the great services, the access to economic opportunity, the great transit, the same things that drive up real estate value are really critical to sustainable households at low income levels. And that is the challenge, right? So how do we leverage that market investment in such a way that we are either adding some portion of those units that are affordable to a broader income spectrum, or at a minimum, finding some ways to leverage some of that development to meet that outcome in other sites or other locations throughout the city. You're also seeing this play out in other communities across the state. A lot of conversation happening in the Grand Traverse area. Their bread and butter is obviously recreation and tourism. And to the extent that those businesses, which are starting to face real challenges in finding employees who are able to live in close proximity to get to work, that's a big concern for the viability of that area and making sure that that tourism industry continues to thrive and continues to be a growth center. Similarly, as you're looking at communities like the city of Detroit with new investment around stadiums and other positive job growths, how do you make sure you're not displacing individuals? So the opportunity to open up inclusionary zoning for a wide variety of communities, and they might apply it in slightly different ways and to different benefits.
But that's really the beauty of inclusionary zoning, right? It lets communities get creative, quite a versatile tool. Is a conversation about opening that up in Ann Arbor, would that be welcomed?
I think so. It was identified in their in the housing affordability report that the city identified.
What about amongst the community?
That bears to be seen. I mean, I think part of the success is how it manifests in those communities, mm-hmm. what kind of goals and parameters. To be clear, you know, if you are developing a project and you are unfettered as to how much rent you can charge and what the value of those units are compared to having to fit that into the context of a community plan or some long-term aspirational goals, that's certainly a balance that's going to come into play. But at the same token, that's what's happening now, right? When you have high-value markets, typically the market's going to move towards maximizing the opportunity and, in fact, the profit in those units, which starts creating this dichotomy and starts creating these separations of economic strata within our community.
Dennis Sturtevant, what about in Grand Rapids? Would residents welcome this conversation and welcome inclusionary zoning?
Well, like almost every issue, I think you would find a large number of residents who would welcome this conversation and this issue and some who wouldn't. You know, the arguments that are used against inclusionary zoning usually run along two main themes. One is by making requirements for developers to include affordable housing units in their development, they're reducing profits for those developers, and they're likely then to look elsewhere to do development in communities that don't have these kinds of requirements, thereby creating an upward pressure on the market because of the lack of available units because developers aren't willing to work in those communities. How true that is across the United States, I'm not sure. I don't think there's been a lot of great research about that. The second issue that people have raised is that it's unfair to place the entire burden of providing affordable housing unit on the developer, and that should be shared across the community. Why don't we take care of it with our taxes that we pay and have it, you know, funneled through the state housing authority or local trust funds or whatever to get this work done instead of burdening the developer with that? So there's some pretty strong opposition from some parts of the community. I've not actually had too many conversations with developers who have that perspective, but I know that nationally that's been kind of the two big arguments against it. The city commission here has been very, very supportive of this, and we see it in most of the actions that they're taking and in this report that they just issued, policy statement they issued at the end of the year. I think they would be very supportive of it and any legislation that might be introduced to try to include inclusionary zoning in state law. But again, I'm suspecting there would be, like everything, some opposition coming, and then we would better understand what the nature of that opposition is in Michigan. But I'm thinking it would probably go along the lines that I mentioned earlier if there was.
And I would just jump onto that a bit. I mean, I think one of the challenges of having this conversation widely is that as housing becomes more segregated by income, this has a cost to our overall economic growth potential. For example, as part of our study, we highlight some analysis done by PolicyLink, something called the National Equity Atlas, which race and poverty are very close proxies to each other demographically within most communities across the country, including, in our case, Washtenaw County. And what the Equity Atlas does is it analyzes that racially inclusive communities tend to perform better, they tend to have better economic growth potential, and they tend to sustain challenges to their economy and sustainability on a more on a stronger basis. And so when you're talking about that balance of private and public sector support for how we're achieving these goals, absolutely critical conversations. And I think in at least our two communities, you'll find that there's support on both of those fronts. But to the end that we're successful in integrating our housing, in the case of that analysis that PolicyLink did for our county, it would have had about a $1.4 billion positive impact to our GDP in 2012. There are obviously some narrow applications of how that would work on a project-by-project basis, but it also has some implications for our overall growth potential going forward.
As you look across the landscape of the country, really, how much evidence have you seen that IZ is working in other communities? And by that, I mean that it's both increasing the number of affordable housing units and at the same time, it's not slowing the growth of market rate housing. What do you see, Brad?
Well, I think that's the balance in the application of it. From my lens, the first step is to start some of that research now and to try to answer that question. Right now, it's not really a viable tool. I think that is the balance. When you're looking at a market, and Ann Arbor is going to be very different than Ypsilanti or Washtenaw County, different than the Grand Rapids, but opening up that tool so that we can have those conversations. And I think there is going to be a bit of a balance there to figure out to what extent are you able to leverage that investment to achieve some affordable units, or as Dennis said, is it a fee in lieu or some other opportunity to invest alternatively into affordable housing. I really do think that's going to manifest in different geographies, different housing targets, maybe even different income targets. So I think the best fix would be to allow each community to say, we've done this analysis, we've identified these priority goals, and this is how particularly we would like it to apply it to our real estate market to see how that balance works.
Brett Lenhart is Interim Director of the Department of Community and Economic Development for Washtenaw County. And Dennis Sturtevant was with us from Grand Rapids, where he's Executive Director of the housing nonprofit Dwelling Place. Gentlemen, thanks so much to both of you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
From a developer's point of view, inclusionary zoning is deceptively simple on paper. In practice, IZ is tough to get right.
It sounds really easy to do, and that would solve all the problems, but there's a lot of unintended consequences.
Mark McDaniel is the president of the Michigan Housing Council and CEO of Synair, a nonprofit housing corporation. He points to what happened in Maryland.
They were kind of the first ones, due to some Supreme Court cases, that got into using zoning or just ordinances that required, if you're going to do market rate development, you had to do at least 20% of the units as affordable. Just blanket across everything. And in some cases that works, and in some cases that's not a good mix of housing. And also just in what you're trying to accomplish in a particular development district. When you have people that really know how to administer it and how to use it, it can be effective, but it's something you got to be really careful about doing.
As to why more developers don't build multifamily affordable housing?
It's a type of a business model that not everybody can do because it's very complex. It's very complex financing. It's more than just going to a bank and getting a mortgage and putting some of your own money into the deal and going out and building, developing, owning something. To have this type of housing be affordable, you're looking at layers of financing. I've been involved in deals that have 13 different sources of financing involved in it to keep it affordable. Those 13 sources all coming from different agencies, banks, intermediaries. They all have their own rules, their own partnership agreements. And to try to manage that and have it all like work at the end to start construction, it's an expertise and skill that is very specialized.
But despite all that, McDaniel believes we need affordable housing.
People have a misconception about what affordable housing is. All the years I've been in it, and when you go to do public hearings to try to get a development approved, those public hearings are always filled with a lot of people who have prejudice and just basically misunderstanding of what affordable housing is and who the people are that live in it. Just look at ourselves and our history, our personal histories. When we got out of school, if it was just out of high school and we went to get a job or we got out of college, almost all of us at one time or another qualified for affordable housing and needed it. These are, bank tellers, policemen, nurses, nurse assistants, all the service workers that are out there, serving, even some the people that we hire as right out of college as assistant financial analysts would qualify. It is an important component to any economic toolbox in any community that you pay attention and you make affordable housing part of your economic strategy. But unfortunately, the perception of it is something that everybody looks at Cabrini Greens of Chicago as their definition of what affordable housing is, and that's really a mistaken viewpoint.
Which brings us to the central question of this State of Opportunity special. What's at stake for Michigan, for our communities, if we don't figure out a way to make more housing more affordable for more people?
I think we'll become more economically segregated. I think we'll become more racially segregated. I think that'll start compromising our ability to be great places. And then very practically, it'll become very challenging for people who grow up in these high-value communities to have their children be able to come home and start professions or to even age in place.
There are so many young people who are graduating with a huge debt burden, and they will choose, I think, for example, and in fact I've heard this, why come to Michigan if I have to pay that amount of rent? I might as well go to Chicago where there are even more big city amenities.
erosion of the middle class across the state is a likely outcome of some of this if we aren't finding ways to address the issue. You know, what's the economic impact on families if, you know, people working in service industries and lower paying jobs and stuff are actually having essentially a surcharge on their income because they can't afford to live near where they work? So there's just all kinds of issues that surface if we don't try to address the issue of affordable housing in every community in the state.
And there's more. All hour, we've heard Gwyneth Hayes and Melvin Parson tell us their stories. What they've been able to do since finding stable housing should leave us all wondering, how many thousands more people are out there in Michigan just like them? And how much have all of our communities missed out on because we haven't been able to address our lack of affordable housing in Michigan?
Well, now I have my master's in social work, and I just recently got a job as a housing specialist where I drive around in the city of Detroit and help individuals with disabilities who are experiencing housing crisis find homes. And I make just enough money now that I no longer qualify to be in the program. I'm just over the threshold. So I have to move out by May 1st. So we'll see how this goes. I'm going out into the real world and having to pay real rent.
Some of the things that have been accomplished as a result of affordable housing in my life is the ability to go back to school and to be able to have the focus to study, right? You know, because I don't have to concern myself with housing. I've become somehow or another, I've become a stakeholder in my community as a result of affordable housing. I am also a person in recovery, and affordable housing has been a great stress reliever in relation to that aspect of my life. I started a farming initiative as a result of affordable housing. So much of who I am today and the opportunities that I have and the things that I'm able to do greatly, deeply connected to affordable housing.
You've been listening to a State of Opportunity special here on Michigan Radio. We welcome your thoughts and your ideas. Search for State of Opportunity on Facebook. Tweet us at State of Op with two P's. Or as always, at the State of Opportunity link at michiganradio.org. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. The special was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Contributors are Mike Blank, Ellie Billings, Sean McHenry, Cass Adair, Ryan Grimes, and Amelia Zach. This State of Opportunity special is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.